From Springfield, this is State Week, a program of analysis and commentary on the events that made news this past week in Illinois state government and politics.
Now taking the stand in his own defense, the former Illinois House Speaker, Michael Madigan. A surprise move in court during Madigan's racketeering and bribery trial. We'll talk about it. And also, a new General Assembly begins, but did finish up some loose ends and tie those up before the lame duck session ended this week. All of that coming up here on State Week. I'm Sean Crawford in Springfield. Our panel includes Charlie Wheeler, Professor Emeritus and former Director of the Public Affairs Reporting Program at the University of Illinois Springfield. And Charlie's also been a longtime Statehouse reporter and observer. And our guest this week, good to have back with us, is Dave McKinney from WBEZ. Dave, thanks for being here.
Hey, Sean, thanks for having me.
So, Dave, you've been covering the Madigan trial. So before we get into what was said there this week, this decision for him to take the stand, did people see that coming? Because it sure seemed like it was a big surprise.
Well, no. I mean, there had been no clues in court given other than, you know, a few weeks back, Mike McLean's lawyer, had signified that he was not going to be having McLean testify. But Madigan's lawyers never came out and said what they were going to do one way or the other. And really on Tuesday morning, the only kind of sense that something was amiss was that suddenly Madigan had a gigantic contingent of people in the courtroom, including his four kids. His wife was not there, but, you know, Lisa Madigan, the former four-term attorney general, was there along with siblings Andrew, Tiffany, and Nicole. And so that was really kind of the first clue. And then that afternoon, Tuesday, is when he took the stand. But I think, you know, in terms of surprise, you know, and we can talk about this more here in a moment. But I mean, for the defense to do a move like this, it had to have been very carefully choreographed. I mean, almost in the way that during a campaign, for example, you know, politicians heading into debates, you know, they do debate prep. I mean, and I strongly suspect that there was, you know, something very similar to that going on here with Madigan, where he would have had to have been given, you know, some kind of lengthy preparation. You know, these are the questions you'll be asked and what have you. So he'd be prepared. And so that would be my guess that they had this in the works for some period of time, but just had not given any kind of a clear signal.
So you may have a strategy when you have a client take the stand. They want to get something across, but you also open up yourself, and it can be a very risky move. Quite often it can backfire on people. What is the concern here that maybe the legal experts, Dave, are thinking when it comes to Madigan opening himself up there on the stand?
Well, I mean, you don't have to go back very far. I mean, you know, the case, the big case that preceded this one, the one involving the four former ComEd executives and lobbyists, including McLean, that involved testimony from two of those defendants, the former ComEd CEO Ann Promajori and the former company lobbyist John Hooker. And, you know, I know in talking to jurors from that trial, you know, their testimony just landed like a lead balloon. I mean, people by that point had been given so much evidence in the form of recordings and emails and what have you. It was just a gigantic Hail Mary to you know, to try to think that testimony like that could sort of undo some of the damage that all of that evidence had done. And Madigan faces a similar situation here where, you know, this trial started, the testimony, I believe, was like, you know, it was late October when mid to late October when this testimony started, evidence started being presented. And you know, so far, the feds have introduced close to 200 different secret FBI recordings, hundreds of emails. And so, you know, there's I think a pretty clear story here that the feds have sort of beaten into this jury. And now the test for Madigan is, can he undo that? Can he change what their potential thinking is after kind of hearing just one side of this case?
Charlie, I've never been a juror. I've been called for jury duty several times, but I got to say, if I'm on a jury and someone's fighting for their life in court, and really Madigan at his age, he is. I mean, he could very well go to prison for this and never come out. If somebody's not guilty, I guess there's a part of me that always wonders, you know, why would they not explain their innocence up there or why they should not be convicted. There's a part of me that always thinks that when I see it. And I understand the other side and the legal ramifications, but knowing Madigan the way you do, are you surprised that that this action was taken?
I think I was surprised in that, as Dave said, there were really no indications ahead of time that this was going to happen. But thinking about it and the way his testimony is laid out, at least what I've read, and Dave, you can correct me if I'm wrong, it seemed like at the beginning they were trying to portray Madigan as almost like somebody who had a bad childhood and had all kinds of hard knocks and came up the hard way and worked hard and tried to help people. And they were trying to portray him in a more favorable light as a human being than what the prosecution was laying out, that he was this mastermind behind this evil scheme. And it also occurred to me that his part of his defense may be to try and shift a lot of the blame for this stuff onto Mike McLean, saying in essence that, well, Mike did a lot of this stuff and he kind of presented himself as doing it with my blessings, but I didn't know about a lot of it, and I certainly wouldn't approve of XYZ. I don't know. That's kind of my initial take. And Dave, you can correct me if I'm way off base.
Well, I mean, it is accurate. I think, you know, it was interesting in testimony. I forget if it was day one or day two of Madigan's testimony, but I think it was with McLean's lawyer when he was questioning Madigan. He's like, you know, you guys have had a friendship that dates back to the 1970s. Has that friendship survived? And Madigan said it had until recently. So, you know, that really caught my ear, because it's like, you know, they're now, you know, now it appears we've learned that these two co-defendants aren't really friends anymore. And so it would be the logical play on Madigan's part to try to throw McLean under the bus. And there was a little bit of, you know, a kind of a straddling of the fence, if you will, because, you know, it's like he's got to be careful. He doesn't want to do something that convicts himself, Madigan, but like, you know, he has this problem where he can say that McLean was saying and doing all of these things without his authority and he didn't know about it. But yet some of these recordings between Madigan and McLean contradict that. And so I think that's how he's got to kind of navigate through this, because I just don't see how you can, you know, how you can say that on some of these hiring decisions, for example, that Madigan himself knew nothing about them, because they're talking about them, McLean and Madigan, on phone calls. You know, the feds wiretapped McLean's cell phone for a period of time, and that's where these calls with Madigan wound up being recorded.
And that, I'm guessing, is what prosecutors are licking their chops at here, is being able to play some of these recordings again, have Madigan on the stand, make him answer to some of that. I mean, wouldn't that possibly be a real pivotal moment in this case, you would think?
Well, it is. And you know, what's interesting is there's one particular recording from the two of these guys talking that so far defense lawyers, both in the ComEd case and in this case, have succeeded in barring, you know, keeping them from being submitted as evidence. It's a recording where Madigan and McLean are talking about a contractor with ComEd, the former Chicago Federation of Labor president, Dennis Gannon, getting hired as a consultant with ComEd. And that in itself, you know, Gannon's name has never really come up in this trial. He's not one of the sort of the ghost subcontractors who, you know, the Madigan precinct captain guys that would get these jobs that paid hundreds of thousands of dollars, and yet they never did any work. But what's significant about this recording is that McLean and Madigan are talking sort of in the plural sense. You know, they talk about Gannon, but then they said, yes, some of these guys have made out like bandits for doing, you know, little work. And they're both laughing about it. And it, you know, in the ComEd trial, Judge Leinenweber said that couldn't go in because A, it involved Gannon, but it was also very potentially prejudicial to the defendants. And the same argument here, where this really could sort of taint the jury in a way, but with Madigan's testimony, where he said he knew nothing about any of these subcontractors, he handed all of that over to McLean to figure out, didn't know they were doing work, was angry when he found out, in some cases, he said, as a result of what the government made public. The fact that Madigan said that on the stand under direct examination from his own lawyer, that has now opened the door to get allow the prosecutors to get that evidence put into the record, because there was a lengthy argument on the last day of trial Wednesday where the prosecution said, wait a minute, he said all this stuff. We think that this made out like bandits tape should be allowed back in. And the judge said, yeah, the door is open now. And so we expect that will be played when the prosecutors get their hands on Madigan sometime early next week, maybe as early as Monday.
Yeah, Charlie, I mean, I think people forget at times that Madigan, while being this longtime politician and power broker in the state, he also is an attorney, not always doing criminal defense work, but he does understand the law. So I'll give him the benefit that at least he knows what risk he's taking when he takes the stand. I mean, you'd agree with that, wouldn't you?
Oh, yeah. And I'm not, familiar enough with the case or with the inner workings, obviously, to know that he and his defense team, weighing the risks against the potential benefit, they obviously have concluded that the risks are worth taking for what they hope will be the benefit. And as I said earlier, one of the things that, from what I've read, it appears he's attempting to shift a lot of the blame for this stuff onto Mike McLean. And I think at some point they're also going to get into the fact that Danny Solis is basically a liar. He was a mole that the government put up to try and entrap me. Acevedo was the same thing. And these were two witnesses that the prosecution put on there and that they have on tape. And I think, again, Madigan is going to hope to discredit them. In the case of Solis, the feds already had him caught, and to try and save his own skin somewhat, he decided to be a mole and rat out Madigan.
Well, before we move on, Dave, Mike McLean, and just explain for us how this works when you have two defendants in court. McLean's attorney can cross-examine Madigan as well, right?
Yeah, that's the way it works. I mean, the evidence it's essentially two trials being kind of merged into one trial, where the government is presenting the same evidence against both defendants. And you know, in this 23 count indictment, they specify which defendants these different counts apply to, but that's been part of it. And you know, the cross-examination of Madigan by McLean's lawyer was generally pretty mild. I mean, aside from that one kind of penetrating question that revealed the two of them seemed to no longer be friends, it was mild. I thought that, you know, on the stand, under questioning from his own lawyer, Dan Collins, Madigan did not do badly. I mean, he did present a competing narrative that all of this was the work of kind of a lone wolf, the guy that was way off the reservation in Madigan's mind, doing things that Madigan never authorized him to do or would condone. And so he did, in that kind of controlled, sort of sympathetic questioning, I think he did come across okay, where he gave very short, precise answers. He at times, you know, laughed about things. He talked about, you know, his relationship with Rauner and Blagojevich, and, you know, and it seemed like in a few cases when he would laugh, there would be jurors that would be laughing. And you could see some of the jurors, like when he was saying that, he didn't know about, Frank Olivo, the former 13th Ward alderman, getting a no work ComEd gig, or Ray Nice, one of his precinct captains, or Ed Moody, another precinct captain, getting these no work deals, and sort of categorically, you know, expressing ignorance about all of that. You could see some jurors taking notes with that, because again, it's a direct contradiction to what they've heard in evidence up until this point. But I do think really we're going to see, you know, probably in you know, now in the fourth month of this trial, the most dramatic moments about to unfold here, when and I'm not sure which prosecutor it is going to be, the guy that you know, the guy that often takes on these confrontational types of questioning, Amr Bacu, if he's the one squaring off against Madigan, I mean, it's going to be really remarkable. And I just wish that there was some way for the public to be able to witness all of this. I mean, the public, of course, can go to the courthouse and sit in on proceedings. They also can consume media like, you know, WBEZ or the Sun-Times. But like, you know, it's a moment where it's unfortunate that it's not captured on television or live stream, so all of Illinois can watch this unfold, because it's really going to be a dramatic moment.
So you mentioned this trial going to be possibly getting to its, I don't know, culmination, we can say, I guess. We don't know, though, when it's going to end exactly. And you mentioned 4 months, I guess, here. So, you know, what are we looking at? Do we have any idea how much longer this is going to go on?
I mean, this thing, because we, you know, because you've got dual defendants and you've got teams of lawyers for both of those defendants butting heads with the prosecutors, this thing has really just, you know, broke through every previous estimate that they've made in terms of how long the thing was going to take. I mean, you know, at the get-go, the judge informed, after talking to the lawyers, informed jurors that he expected this to all be wrapped up prior to Christmas. And well, here we are after Christmas. And now the latest thinking is that, you know, the actual kind of courtroom piece of this may not be wrapped up until the very end of January. Part of that is that you know, we had one day this past week with President Carter's funeral, which the court was dark. We've got the Martin Luther King holiday coming up. The court's dark. They've not been doing court on Fridays. And so it's a high likelihood that we will probably get into February before this actually winds up in the lap of the jury. And you can sense there is, I wouldn't say frustration, but mounting angst, I guess, concern, whatever word you want to use, from jurors. Just there've been a couple of notes that have been sent to the judge from the jury. One of them a few weeks back came from a juror who had plans to go to the Super Bowl in New Orleans and wanted to know if that trip would still be possible to make. And that's, I believe, the second week of February. And then we had another one, another note come from a juror this past week that just said, hey, when is this going to end? You know, so that it's on their minds clearly as well. Like, how long is this going to go on? But I do think now we're at a spot where it's going to be early February.
Well, let's move on to the Illinois General Assembly. The lame duck session came to an end, and of course, lawmakers sworn in for a new term this week, and there was no change in leadership. All the leaders of each caucus, all four caucuses, remained the same. But Charlie, before the General Assembly term ended, they did finish so a few different issues that were hanging out there. One of those was called Karina's Bill. This has been on the burner for several months, I guess maybe over a year now, and it had to do with domestic violence issues and who can actually have a gun. And so basically, fill us in on what happened there, and do we know what broke the stalemate to get this thing passed?
Yeah, basically what Karina's Bill says, that if a person has an order of protection against him or her, and the alleged victim wants firearms removed from that person, then local law enforcement must temporarily remove guns from the person who has the order of protection against them. The way that the current law would allow people to ask a court for an order of protection, but it doesn't necessarily lead to law enforcement removing guns immediately. The motivation behind this was about a situation in which a woman named Karina Gonzalez, and this was about I want to say, a year and a half ago, and her 15-year-old daughter, Daniela, were fatally shot. And it was in July of 2023, after just a few weeks after she told police about threatening behavior by her husband, Jose Alvarez. She was granted an order of protection. His Alvarez's firearm owner identification card was automatically revoked. He was banned from the family home. Yet a couple weeks later, he shows up in the home with a pistol. He fatally shot his wife and his daughter, and he wounded their 18-year-old son. The legislation would require law enforcement to take away guns from someone in that situation. The bill passed the House 80-33, and it basically would require law enforcement within 96 hours of a judge's order to remove firearms, confiscate the guns from someone who's the subject of that restraining order. Now, the Illinois State Rifle Association and other gun rights advocates and some Republican members argued that the bill violates due process rights for gun owners. The supporters of the bill argued that the people who are subject to the gun confiscation must be deemed an immediate and present danger by a judge with sworn testimony from people asking to have guns removed. So this is a significant piece of legislation, and it will, I think, cut down on the number of people who are killed in these kinds of incidents.
And Charlie, there were also a couple other bills that passed. I mean, give us a quick rundown on those too while we have time.
Yeah, well, one of them that we've been mentioning before is legislation that would require the Department of Children and Family Services to prioritize placing youth with relatives. There's more than 10,000 Illinois youths who live with their relatives, but most of these caregivers are currently denied foster care benefits. And it would require DCFS to pursue federal funding to establish a kinship navigator program to help relatives who have youth in care. The research has shown that child welfare experts have established the benefits of foster children staying with kin as opposed to staying with someone who's not related to them. They say that these arrangements offer children more stability, decrease the trauma they experience, improve their mental health, and reduce the number of times the child is moved from home to home. So that's another one that passed. Another one that I found interesting was the legislature cleared a measure that would allow the state of Illinois to transfer to the Prairie Band Potawatomi Nation some 1,500 acres that largely covers what the tribe's original reservation was. Most of it is now the Shawano State Park, and under the land transfer legislation, the state and the tribe would have to execute a land management agreement, which would require the park to continue to be operated as a park and open to the public. And the background of this is, in 1829, almost 200 years ago, the Treaty of Prairie du Chien granted the Prairie Band Potawatomi 2 square miles in what is now DeKalb County. And what happened was the chief and several members of his extended family lived on the reservation, but other tribal members left Illinois, moved to northeast Kansas, where the tribe is now headquartered. Around 1849, Chief Chabanet traveled west to Kansas to check on his tribal members there. While he was gone, the federal government declared the reservation land abandoned and sold it at a public auction. This is going to correct a egregious, basically, land theft that occurred, as I said, almost 200 years ago. All it requires now is for this land management, the governor will sign the bill, and then the land management agreement has to be worked out in the final couple of days of the General Assembly.
Let's move on to our notes from the field. So, Dave, we'll go to you first with this one.
A thing that caught my eye, Sean, was a finding that came down from the Executive Ethics Commission on Friday. It involved a former Pritzker administration official who guided Illinois through the pandemic. That's the former state public health director, Ngozi Ezike. She had left the state in 2022 to take a job with Sinai Hospitals in Chicago as the CEO of that organization. Well, a complaint was filed under the state ethics law alleging that she had violated a provision of that it's the revolving door prohibition. And what that means is that, you know, if you're a high-ranking agency executive, you're not allowed to go work for a contractor, a company that has contracts in the agency that you work in, that you oversee. And in this case, Sinai had over $4 million in state contracts. And the law says that you have to wait a year before you go to work for a contractor like that. And she waited just a couple of months. And so there was a settlement that was reached where there was an acknowledgement that she did not knowingly violate that revolving door provision, but she accepted that it was a violation, and then also agreed to pay $150,000 fine as a result of that. So that's certainly a hefty fine. And I can't tell you if it's the largest one ever paid, but it's right up there. So significant fine there for the state or the former state public health director.
All right. And Charlie.
Well, the Illinois Flash Index showed strength in December, rising to 102.4 from its November reading of 102, according to U of I Professor Emeritus Fred Geertz, who compiles the index for the Institute of Government and Public Affairs. That's the highest mark since the 102.5 posted in June. And the professor said, while 2024 was eventful in the nation and world, the U.S. and Illinois economy showed remarkable stability. After some delay, the inflation rate moderated, while the unemployment rate in both the state and nation rose but remained low. The economy continued to grow at a reasonable rate, and talk of an imminent recession has nearly vanished. This may be the elusive soft landing, the professor said. And the Commission on Government Forecasting and Accountability, which is the legislature's fiscal gurus, reported that the Illinois General Fund's receipt in December rose $327 million as compared to last December. Income tax grew $445 million on a net basis. Corporate income taxes were pretty flat, but the holiday shopping season propelled growth in sales tax receipts. And it all adds up to the fact that for the first 6 months of the current fiscal year, revenues are slightly ahead of last year's pace. State revenues are up $750 million in the first 6 months of FY25 compared to the first 6 months of 2024, which is roughly a 3% increase.
That's all the time we have for this episode of State Week. Our panel included Charlie Wheeler and Dave McKinney of WBEZ. Look for State Week where you get your podcasts through the NPR app and at nprillinois.org. I'm Sean Crawford. Join us next time.
You've been listening to State Week, a program of commentary and analysis of events in Illinois state politics and government. State Week is produced in the state capitol by public radio station NPR Illinois. This is IPR, Illinois Public Radio.